Our final reading for tonight comes from Matthew 27, verses 32 through 54. And as they went out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. And then they sat down and kept watch over him there, and over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then two robbers who were crucified with him, one on the right hand and one on the left, and those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes and the elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" The robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way. Now from the sixth hour, there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out loud with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani?" That is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders hearing it said, "This man is calling Elijah." And one of them at once ran and took a sponge and filled it with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. But the other said, "Wait, let's see whether Elijah will come to save him." And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And the earth shook, the rocks were split, the tombs also were open, and many of the bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tomb, after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." Did you hear it? It's that title, the title that they kept calling Jesus, Son of God. Son of God. That title shows up 8 times in Matthew's account of Jesus' life. And half of those times, they're right here in these chapters, these last chapters that describe the final hours before Jesus' death. Son of God. We didn't read it, but only a few verses earlier at his trial, the religious leaders had demanded to know from Jesus, "Tell us, are you the Christ, the Son of God?" This wasn't actually the first time that someone had challenged Jesus about being the Son of God. You know the first 2 times that that title is used in the book of Matthew? It shows up in chapter 4, during Jesus' temptations in the wilderness and the devil's sneers. "If you really are the Son of God." See, at his baptism, Jesus and those around him had heard God the Father thunder with pride, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased." And so, of course, where does the Prince of Darkness attack Jesus immediately afterwards? What does he do as he tries to shake Jesus' confidence in his Father and in the plan that they had made from the beginning of time to rescue the world? Well, Satan attacks Jesus' identity as the Son of God. "If you really are the Son of God, surely God would have better plans for you than this. How about you do things my way? It'd be so much easier." But unlike the first human beings who caved under Satan's temptations and rebelled in mistrust against their Father God, Jesus, he's the perfect Son. He is the Son of God, the Son of God who clung to his Father's words and he weathered Satan's attacks, but Satan wasn't done. In another account of Jesus' temptation in Luke chapter 4, verse 13, we hear that the prince of darkness simply left Jesus until an opportune time. So is it any wonder then that in these final hours before his death, Satan would launch a full-scale attack and he would put this mocking theme in the mouths of Jesus' enemies? Are you the Son of God? You, the Son of God? Would the Son of God really be standing trial before the religious leaders of God's own people? Would the Son of God really be hanging naked, helpless on a torture device used by Roman overlords to execute rebels? Questions, the mocking, all of it targeted Jesus' very identity when he would have been most weak, when he was most vulnerable to caving. Are you the Son of God? Hey, if you're a Christian, you've probably heard this story so often that maybe you don't feel the scandal of it. And if you aren't a Christian, you're probably more likely to experience the story the way that you're meant to feel the weight of that question. Is this really what would happen to the Son of God? The honest answer that just about anybody who doesn't know this story would give to this question is no. No, this isn't what should happen to the Son of God. And there was definitely no one in Jesus' day who thought that this would be the fate of someone claiming to be the Son of God. Not even Jesus' own best friends and his followers. Let me give you an example. It's actually from one of the other 8 times that the title Son of God shows up in Matthew. And it should have been a glorious moment. Because you see, after about 3 years of doing life with Jesus, one of his good friends named Peter, he finally seems to get the picture. He finally seems to understand who this Jesus is, this incredible man that Peter has been getting to know so closely. Jesus had asked his friends this question, "Who do you say that I am?" And so very typical of Peter, he's got a ready answer. No hesitation. "You're the Christ. You're the Son of God." And Peter seems to get it until it's only all too painfully obvious that he actually doesn't. Because right after, Jesus starts to reframe for his followers what it means that he is the Christ, the Son of God. Because he knew what they would expect. You see, for many Jews in Jesus' day, Son of God, that was a title given to kings. The king was God's son, ruling by divine right. Read things like that in Psalm 2. And so for Peter and Judas and many of Jesus' followers, they looked to Jesus and they expected a king. A son of David, specifically, a king who would raise up a revolutionary army and drive those Roman overlords back into the Mediterranean. And so when Jesus started talking about how he would suffer at the hands of their own religious leaders and be killed, Peter, you just can't take it. It's not what should happen, not to the Son of God. And so he takes Jesus aside to correct him. "Jesus, this isn't leadership. Talk like that, it's just not good for morale. This isn't what it means to be the Son of God." But Jesus hears the one who is really behind Peter's words, and maybe you can hear it. If you really are the Son of God, would this be the right road? Is this what it looks like to be the Son of God? So maybe now you understand why Jesus' response to his good friend seems so harsh. He says, "Get behind me, Satan. You are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." You hear what Jesus is saying? Because you see, Peter, you and me, in our very human understanding of how things work, we expect the Son of God, as the top of the food chain, to use his power the way that we would, right? To do everything in his power to make his life comfortable, to avoid suffering at all costs. I mean, think about it, right? If you had all power, what kind of story would you write for yourself and your life? It probably wouldn't be all that different from the stories that we human beings have always written about the gods of our own imagining. But the real Son of God, he and his Father planned a different story. A story where God doesn't stand aloof from human suffering, but becomes man. Not to enjoy human pleasures, but to endure human suffering. The suffering that we brought on ourselves and on our world by rebelling against our God in the first place. Because friends, you know why suffering and evil exists? It's because of us. Our first ancestors, Adam and Eve, they knew what it was like to be children or sons of God in a perfect world. But they listened to the devil's attacks on their God's character and on their identity as his servants. And they caved. They rebelled. They broke relationship with God. And in doing that, they broke the world that God had made to exist in relationship with him. You pour apple juice into your gas tank, what do you get? A lot of suffering for your poor car. In that same way, a world that's made to run on relationship with God can only know suffering and pain when we rebel against God and we make ourselves his enemy. This world becomes a hell of our own making. And God could very well have left it that way. He could have left us human beings to suffer the consequence of our rebellion, and he would have been perfectly right to do so. In fact, that might be what we would expect from somebody at the very top of the food chain. But that is not the kind of God he is. Our God, he enters into the suffering of his people. The Son of God became a son of man to show us that God will not leave human beings to suffer alone. But even more beautifully, the Son of God became a son of man to endure the worst of our sufferings for us in our place. You hear it in Jesus' cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? The Son of God should never have had to say those words. You know who should have? You and me. We who in our sinful rebellion again and again turn our backs on God. We are the ones who deserve to have God turn his back on us, to have God walk out on us for all the ways that we continue to walk out on him, to reject him, to choose our own thing. And yet the Son of God said, let me take the punishment. Let me take the rejection that they deserve for their rebellion. Treat me like the one who has cast relationship with God behind my back, so that God's people can know what it looks like for God to pursue them and to draw them back into relationship. I wonder, what would you say is the worst kind of suffering? Now, we might disagree on this, but I would say relational suffering. Because think about it. You can have a broken femur and get through it because of the love and the care of all your strongest relationships around you. In fact, I think it's precisely strong relational bonds that help us get through the worst of physical, mental, emotional suffering. But relational suffering? Rejection? Broken hearts? The shattering of those primary relationships? The stony face and cold shoulder? Relational suffering, I think, is one of the worst. And that is the suffering that's caused from just our human relationships. So now, imagine the depth of anguish that comes from suffering full relational rupture with the God that we are made for. To be completely cut off from any trace of his kindness and gracious presence. To know only his right and his just anger against us for our rebellion. The fire of his stony silence for our rejection, friend, that's nothing less than hell. And that's the kind of hell that you hear in the suffering Son of God's cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? See, the physical pain that Jesus endured, it was terrible. But Jesus' bloody, torn body was simply an outward manifestation of far worse internal suffering that he faced as he faced hell in our place. The suffering that you and I deserved. The suffering that the Son of God willingly bore in our place. Suffering so that you and I wouldn't have to know the hell of being forsaken by God for the ways that we have forsaken him, but instead could know eternal relationship with him. See, you and I, if we had been writing this story, I don't think we ever would have imagined a suffering Son of God. But it's the story that changes lives. And it did so the moment Jesus died. It's the last time we hear this title, Son of God, in Matthew. The Roman centurion. This butchering cog in the bloody Roman war machine. This battle-hardened vet who had seen countless lives end. Standing beneath the cross of the suffering Son of God, this man who's just, oh, too familiar with death, he sees something very different in Jesus' suffering and in his death. And he sees what no one else there saw that day. Truly, this man was the Son of God. And I believe in that moment, this Roman centurion, the last person that anyone would have expected, I think he was rescued from hell that he deserved by the suffering of the Son of God. So here's the question for us tonight. Who do you say? Who do you say that Jesus is? It's the question he asked his followers. Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that Jesus is? Who in the crowd are you? As you look on the suffering of the Son of God tonight, do you join the skeptics and the mockers? Or, like the centurion, do you trust? Do you trust and do you say, Jesus, he truly is the Son of God, the one who didn't cave under Satan's attacks, the one who chose to enter into our suffering, who suffered in my place, the one who frees me from the hell that I deserve, the one who has earned for me the relationship with the God that I am made for, the Son of God, who became a son of man, so that through his suffering, he might make us children. He might make us sons of God again.